We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Will Weber is on the board. Will Erskine booking the guests. In the newsroom, Dinah Weeks and Dave Woodard. We want to thank the Mormon Tabernacle Choir who flew in today for the show. Oh, never mind. They won't be performing as they are stuck at the Toronto airport.
Scott Thompson.
That's just so disappointing. So many guests and just haven't been able to make it in. Good afternoon. It is 900 CHML. I'm Scott Thompson. Will Weber is on the board. Erskine booking the guests. Diane and Dave in the newsroom. Jump into the fun. Love to hear from you. Send us a note, Scott Thompson, at 900CHML.com. And the phone lines are always open at 905-645-3221, star 9900 on your cell. We would love to hear from you. And a little later on in the show, we'll talk a little bit more about the Pope's visit and, a pretty emotional week, let's be honest, and certainly historical and groundbreaking on both the Indigenous community and the Catholic Church. Obviously, not everybody is happy about what has happened, but certainly a first step, and I don't think too many people can disagree with that. That being said, not everybody was happy with wording, certain things that were said or that weren't said. On the other hand, many are surprised that they went as far as they did, obviously to make this visit especially about the Indigenous community and such. Now, obviously, what will happen is what happens moving after the Pope has returned to the Vatican. What happens with this issue? Does it stay in the forefront? Is it still a priority for the Catholic Church? So here's an interesting report from Canadian Press, Karen Rebo, on a sum-up of last week's visit.
The former Manitoba Regional Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Ken Young, believes the Pope failed to make the acknowledgement during his Canadian visit last week because Canadian Catholic Church officials failed to brief him properly. Francis apologized multiple times throughout the week for abuses at Catholic-run residential schools, but he didn't use the word genocide until he was asked about it by reporters on his plane back to Rome. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission referred to residential schools as a form of cultural genocide in its 2015 report, and since then, several Indigenous groups have amended this to say it was genocide. Karen Rebo, The Canadian Press.
I have a hard time believing that everybody, officials on both sides, on everything, everybody knows what's going on. I don't think things are getting lost in the sauce. I don't think they're getting lost in translation. I don't think that there's side issues that the church doesn't know about. Everybody who's involved in this issue knows exactly what's going on. So I have a hard time believing that, the messaging is being, or the translation is being lost in the messaging and saying this, saying that. I think everybody knows and is treading quite delicately on with the words that they choose. And I think because it all comes down to money. At the end of the day, if you admit too much, you open yourself to more liability. And obviously, restitution has to be paid to the Indigenous community. And again, this is all about choosing delicately the right words to make sure you express your opinion, you get across what you're trying to get across, but you don't open yourself up too much to what is going on. And again, at the end, this is going to be about money. It's going to be about restitution. You can talk the talk, but if you're not going to walk the walk and dole out, then the words are worthless. And it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next little while to see how the Catholic Church follows up on all of this. And certainly credit to the Indigenous community who have certainly held people's feet to the fire here for decades and eventually got their apology, eventually got the attention of the Pope and his attention enough to bring him here to Canada to have the visit that he did. So it'll be fascinating to see how this all pans out. All right, another jam-packed show. Tiger Woods turning down an offer that some say are in the neighborhood of $700-800 million. The Live Golf Series. We'll talk more about that coming up a little later on. Also, repercussions, as we mentioned, about the Pope's visit and what happens moving forward. Also, going to talk about the Open Streets Project and the closure of King Street. Still chatting about that and having some sort of festival and such. Great idea. I think we should look into this stuff more and more. We'll talk about that coming up with Jason Farr from Hamilton East Stony Creek coming up a little bit later on. Also, a drone strike killing, obviously an important integral part of Al-Qaeda. We'll talk about that coming up a little later on the world stage. Also, Nancy Pelosi in Taiwan. Many are questioning whether this is a good time for, to be doing or how holding such a visit. We'll talk about that, break it down, and what it all means. Again, talk more about the Pope's visit as well and what it has meant to truth and reconciliation in this country and with the Indigenous community. Also, Hockey Canada, going to talk about them coming up in the final hour and where they go from here moving forward. Interesting angle coming out before we run on the holiday weekend on Friday, and minor hockey associations are now asking for some sort of explanation from Hockey Canada as to what's going on, where the funds are going, once we're starting to hear allegations of payouts and such and using special slush funds in order to do so. Many parents not happy with the direction minor hockey's going. And now, as they say, change is needed at the top all the way down. Now minor hockey putting the pressure on Hockey Canada to get its act in order. Oddly enough, as we get an email, we didn't that's a coincidence. Got an email on Friday saying, hey, it's still not too late to sign up for minor hockey. Hope that, you know, the kids still want to play. So obviously timing is everything. We'll talk about that coming up a little later on as well. When in doubt, follow the moolah, follow the money, the money, the money, the money. And whether that's Truth and Reconciliation or whether that's the Live Golf Series, Saudi funded, many top players have been offered a fortune to go over and play. Greg Norman says that Tiger Woods was offered somewhere in the area between $700-800 million just to take part in the series. Does it do anything for the game? Is it just taking the money and running? And do we look differently at that sort of thing now? Let's bring in Alyssa Freeman, PR pop culture expert, with us now. Alyssa, hope you're doing well and had a great long weekend.
I did. I hope you did too, Scott.
So far, so good. Let me ask you your thoughts first on the visit with the Pope. It's obviously left before the weekend. Your thoughts as we sort of regurgitate everything that's happened and such, and whether this visit was a successful visit and what needs to be done moving forward.
I think that when the Pope first came, I think we were all agog and we thought, you know, he's here and he has come to say, I'm sorry. But I think, like many people, and I listen to a lot of interviews from people from First Nations and the Indigenous peoples, and I have to agree, I don't think that the Pope went far enough. From what I can tell, he said, you know, this is from, I am sorry that some members of the church. Well, it's not just some members. I mean, the church has to be held responsible. So he did not go as far as that. And the other thing that he didn't go far as was, you know, giving the land back, providing remuneration, reparations, which is something that, honestly, you know, the Vatican should have really done. So I realize this is a very symbolic visit, and there are a lot of people who appreciated it, but more still has to happen. And the other thing I wanted to point out was that, you know, the Pope's visit in Quebec, you know, they thought that hundreds of thousands of people were going to descend upon the Plains of Abraham, and maybe a tenth showed up. So I think that there was a lot of learnings on both sides, that the religion does not attract as many followers and believers as it used to. And I think that that's also something that the church has to take back to the Vatican and consider.
That's a very interesting point. And at the very beginning of this, when he was out west and then went to Edmonton and held a mass in Edmonton in the stadium there, we were told that all of the tickets had been accounted for, were spoken for. And it was obvious to see that it certainly, there were plenty of empty seats in the stadium. So, you know, you have to wonder whether they didn't get to the people who needed them or what have you. But it was very odd that it was a papal visit that there were empty seats.
I think that they'll always say that all the tickets are spoken for, because you can say that that's what it was on paper and just not everybody showed up. But I think that we both remember, what was it, Pope John Paul, when he came to Canada, that was a number of years. We're going back a number of years ago. But it was a frenzy. It was a frenzy. And people could hardly wait to see him. So when I compared that visit to this visit, which had so much more of a weight to it, that there were issues that needed to be resolved, and all eyes of not just Canadians, but of the world were watching, I would have to say that people did not show up in droves as they did compared to back then.
At the end of the day, is this all about the money? Because, you know, people are saying, you know, things are getting lost in translation. Maybe one side didn't know what the other side was talking about, which I just absolutely refuse to buy into any of that. Each side knows exactly what's going on here. Is this all about delicate wording to avoid paying more or what have you? At the end of the day, does this not have to do with money? You admit guilt. You have to supply restitution.
You're 100% correct, Scott. And that's why he did not admit guilt on behalf of the church, because that would have been just the pathway to monetary restitution. But instead, he was very, very carefully worded. Everything was carefully worded throughout the whole visit. And I think that in some cases, Vatican thought, let's just do this, and then we can move past this issue, and we can just get past it. But I don't think that's going to happen. And I think that there are delegations that are still going to be looking for further reparations, and that the Catholic Church and the Vatican is not yet off the hook, and this is still going to haunt them for years to come if they don't do something about it sooner than later.
Do you think we'll hear something about, and then last question of this, do you think this we'll hear something about this in the next month or so, or will this just kind of disappear and become yesterday's news?
Well, if I was the Vatican, I would hope that it would disappear and become yesterday's news. But that's when, you know, for the people who want restitution, that's when you have to start to relook at your narrative and relook at your strategy and advocate for the things that you did not yet get. I think for a lot of people that this was just the first stage, but the second stage is still to come.
All right, let's talk about golf. The LIV Golf Series, for those that don't know anything about it, it's Saudi Arabian funded, designed to, many say, be just a giant distraction and offer pro golfers a tremendous amount of money to take part in the series. Those in the PGA, of course, frowning at all of this, saying that this goes against the development of the sport and the young people coming up and such, and just chasing the funds. We're getting word now that from Greg Norman that apparently Tiger turned down between $700 and $800 million. What are your thoughts on this, on chasing the money? And considering what we've seen with Elon Musk's in the world now, do people frown on this now?
I don't know if they frown on it, but I will say that I actually looked up Tiger's net worth before I came on. And as of 2018, he was worth $760 million. And they were saying, what do they offer, $700 million? How much money can one person have, Scott?
Yeah.
But if you're not looking at that, then I think what Tiger's beef with the whole thing was is that you're just giving money up front, and there's nothing about grinding, there's nothing about competing, and that it's just too easy, and it's not really about truly enjoying the purest form of the game of golf versus just showing up. And this is a different type of golf series that attracts, I think, a different type of crowd. You know, there's music playing, there's more distraction. It's not that sort of that purest form. Hmm. And I think that was really his biggest beef about it. But, you know, typically when you wanted the stars to come and the big players to come to your tournament, there, I think, and listen, maybe I just watched too much of that series on HBO Ballers to learn about this, but there's always a guarantee. And when there's a guarantee, that means that whatever happens, you're going to get paid, win or lose. So I think that is his big beef, that there's nothing about grinding out versus just showing up. And that depends on what stage of golf you are, what type of golfer you are. But when you think about it, it also means that all the people who do participate on the tour, they're all going to get some sort of guaranteed income.
Alyssa Freeman with us, PR and pop culture expert, view of the world after a long weekend. As always, Alyssa, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
All right, the apology and such out of the way. What happens next moving forward? What needs to be done for reconciliation with the Indigenous community and the Catholic Church? Let's bring in Dr. Christopher Alcantara, Assistant Editor, CJPS, and Professor, Department of Political Science, University of Western Ontario, and with us now. Doctor, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Yeah, I'm doing quite well. Thanks.
So what are your thoughts as you mull over the last week and what has happened, the emotions that we experienced and the questions and how the tone changed towards the end of the week? What's your thought as you look back on all of this?
I think it was an amazing visit in a lot of ways and disappointing in others. I think I don't think anyone ever saw this moment actually happening where the Pope would actually visit, let alone, give an apology. And I think, it's for some people, it was not enough. But for others, it seemed to have a very powerful effect. And I think it's a positive step for Canada as we move towards, a period of reconciliation, hopefully in the future.
Many are talking about words that were chosen or words that were said or weren't said. What needs to happen moving forward? Obviously, apologies out of the way. What needs to happen moving forward?
Well, I actually did some research on this, looking at government apologies and what are the most effective apologies. And, we looked at three aspects of apologies. Should you say we are sorry or I am sorry, it's our fault, and we're going to fix it. Those are sort of the three things we looked at. And we looked at all combinations of those three elements. And what we found was that the most effective apology was only when you said that I'm going to fix this. And I think that's very clear from this visit that what really matters, yes, we appreciated people saying, the Pope saying, I'm sorry, and that it's the fault of, the fault of Christians and the church for doing some of those things. But what really matters is what's next. And so that's going to be the big thing. And I think what people want to see, they want to see the Catholic Church open up its records, share all the records. They want to see, in many ways, they want to see a truth and reconciliation kind of committee or investigation, such as something similar to what happened in Canada. They want the church to engage in that sort of navel gazing and investigation to really bring out open up all of the dark secrets and bring out everything to the past so that everyone can see what exactly happened and who was at fault. So I think that's the first immediate step that has to happen for sure.
At the end of the day, are the words being selected simply to avoid liability? Because at the end, if you apologize and then admit fault, eventually there comes restitution. What needs to be done there? Rather than wait or tiptoe, should the church try to get ahead of this and try to reach some sort of agreement? Or do you let the Indigenous community continue to drag this out?
No, so absolutely, these words were very carefully chosen. They were written by a huge team of lawyers. Some of the language is borrowed from other apologies that the church has issued, so which you would assume is going to also be legal, very much legal proof. So yeah, I think the Pope's apology and words were very carefully chosen to limit a liability. What should happen next? Yeah, I think the church should be, if it really means the words that it gives, it said that it should be proactive in working with Indigenous communities to find ways of making things right. And so, yeah, that might mean financial settlement for sure. Thinking about that, it might mean creating programs to educate Christians about what the church did and what the church is doing and how they can support Indigenous people. It might mean returning land. I mean, that's at the core of a lot of Indigenous concerns, is about the land. And if the church is serious about this apology, it owns a lot of land. And transferring that land back to Indigenous communities, given the amount of property and wealth that the church owns throughout the world, giving back a bunch of land in Canada is not going to hurt the church's financial situation in the grand scheme of things. So I think that's what needs to happen. I think you're right. Like, Indigenous communities need to be working with the church, but the church should, if it really means what it says, it should be proactive in doing these kinds of things.
Obviously, this isn't the first situation that the Catholic Church has been into like this. This is just another one, another example of. There's sexual misconduct allegations through the church and such. will they be able to withstand all of this?
The church has been here a long time. It's withstood all sorts of threats, right? Political, social, religious, the whole Protestant movement. I think the church is going to survive this for sure.
Moving forward, what does it need to do, though, not only with the Indigenous community, but to solidify its place in society? Many have walked away. We were talking with our last guest that the crowds in Edmonton weren't as big as some thought they would be. Certainly in Quebec, the same sort of thing. Do you think the Catholic Church has some work to do here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, anytime you have an institution that doesn't change very much and a society that's changing, then if you want to maintain members, you have to sort of find ways to remain relevant. It's the same thing with our country, right? We have a constitution built from 1867. It was built for a very, if you think about society in 1867, it's very different compared to today. And so, even our country and its institutions have to bend and change in ways to show that it's relevant to people. And so the church has to do the same. It has to find ways to be relevant to Canadians who face ever more choices for all sorts of things, right? Even in religion, we face so many more choices. And so, there certainly is a competition aspect involved for the church to remain relevant.
Obviously, a very emotional week for the Indigenous community. How should the rest of Canadians view this? Because it's our history and a lot of our history that was erased or tried to be. How do you think the rest of Canada is going to view this sort of thing?
I think there might have been some. I think that most Canadians will just shrug. Those who are not Catholic will just shrug. And partly because, the federal government did apologize already. You know, Canada already went through what the church is doing. The church is just, you know, many years too late to the dance here. And so I think, you know, most Canadians weren't surprised by the visit. Most Canadians who are not Catholics were sort of, you know, not really moved, I think, by the visit in a way that Catholics were, I think. So I think it's just another, but it, you know, I think it's a positive step. It's, and you know, the church was very much involved and guilty for a lot of the things that happened under the residential schools. And so I think that could help Canada move forward and find ways of addressing its dark past in positive ways.
Dr. Christopher Alcantara with us, professor, Department of Political Science, University of Western Ontario, summarizing the Pope's visit and what it means to not only the Indigenous community, but Canadians in general. Chris, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
Thanks, Scott. Bye.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
All right. Obviously, as we're coming out of or living with whatever you want to call it, the global pandemic, and life has changed. I mean, 2.5 years of going through what we've went through. A lot of people, you know, keywords like pivot and change direction and what we're doing and so on and so forth. And a lot of those great suggestions have stuck, and people are saying, you know, we got to live life a little differently than what we have been in the past. And here's another great example. Remember, even just go back to the art crawl and super crawl and when it first started, and you know, people were a little apprehensive about literally shutting down the city for a period of time and such. But again, as we've lived through the pandemic and saw hospitality restaurants and such change the way they do things, many are looking at things that are a little outside the box, a little outside the limits, per se, that we probably wouldn't have approved of before. And including this, a survey of Hamiltonians found widespread support for an open street pilot project that would see King Street East closed to vehicular traffic between Gage and Gore Parks for a one-day street festival. Unfortunately, we're not going to get it done this year, but perhaps in the planning for next year. Let's bring in Jason Farr, City of Hamilton, and with us now. Jason, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Doing great. How about you? Good weekend, long weekend.
Yeah, and lots going on, and it's great because we're starting to see things get back to what they were and new variations of, and this, I think, is something that will only make the cities thrive. If you go to Europe or Italy or any places like this, you see this stuff happening all the time. Is there an appetite for this? How difficult is it to get something like this done, Jason?
Well, as you mentioned in a great introduction, it is a little delayed. We're kind of hoping for this summer, although just sort of started talking about a grander, call it open streets plan for King from Gage to the Gore last year. So, Scott, I think we want to dot all the I's, cross all the T's. Early engagement shows, at least on Engage Hamilton Online, it's quite popular. But, you know, we've done something similar. We are in no way some of those European cities you mentioned, or Holland, or even Bogota, Colombia, where it all started back in 1974. But, you know, closing King on a couple of Sundays would get us a little bit closer. And certainly, you know, there's a popularity there. It's attractive. We know from past open streets, from super crawls, as you mentioned, from some of the permanent promenade infrastructure that we put in since the first open streets. There's definitely a large contingency out there that see this as, you know, a great way to get active. It's attractive. You can see the street in a different way, in a calmer way, and it's environmentally friendly, of course. So there's something to it. It will happen at least twice, probably as a pilot in 2023, but we're still engaging.
This seems like a slam dunk, especially in a post-COVID world. That being said, is there resistance? What is some of the concern?
Well, I can only tell you anecdote. Well, not even anecdote. I had one conversation with one constituent who's a very popular regional-based commercial entity in the core. And, you know, when we're talking about Wellington to the Gore, a lot of this is Ward 3 and a little bit of Ward 2, who had some concerns early when we were talking about it, and people like you and CHML were reporting it. Because they're a regional retail and they do have a big parking lot and they have customers that come from even outside Hamilton. The concerns were, you know, the customers won't come, the street's closed. Other ways to get at that business, always there's options, but there hasn't been a lot. Like I said, we do engage Hamilton really well right now. It gets better and better. It's a really great way for listeners to go online. You can just go to hamilton.ca and see what the latest Engage Hamilton survey is all about. It's very easy to participate. And we had almost 1,000 people on this one. And overwhelmingly, it hasn't been, no. It's like, we got to do this. And you're right. I mean, since the pandemic or during or whatever, like you say, whatever we're calling it now, across the planet, mobility patterns have shifted. You know, there's a lot more walking, statistically a lot more cycling, and people like protected infrastructure there, and just a lot more people wanting to get outside. And, you know, we reacted, I thought, pretty good, especially setting the standard across Ontario, where we just said, let's put patios wherever we can put patios and help our burgeoning restaurant industry, and it ended up catching fire across the city and across the province. So things like that, where you're sitting outside the box, in a lot of cities, you can think of Toronto, and maybe they're in a bit of a mess right now with their open streets that they did on Lakeshore, or at least there's some tumultuous stuff happening with the mayor right now. I'm sure they'll work it all out, but Active Toronto was very, very popular. So it's definitely a field of dreams effect. You build it and they will come. We've seen it in the past on a smaller scale here in the city. And I think, Scott, safely we can say that the popularity of these concepts, even as we tried them as pilots in the past, has led us to do things like our promenade at Piers 5, 6, and 7 that's just about done. Cops Pier, a 30-meter-wide promenade park that wraps around Pier 8 as we speak. I swear to God, more popular than Disneyland. It is just packed. It's like the East Mountain as well, man. Ward 6, you know, the big 5-meter trail that goes around with the solar lights. It's constantly busy with people wanting to get active. They're running, they're cycling, they're rollerblading, and they're taking the stairs. And it seems whenever we do these things, and it's the reason why we have a division in the city, you know, a sustainable mobility division, and our manager, Peter Dobolovich, is a well-recognized individual. When we put these things together, they work for sure.
Great idea, and obviously when you see the success of things like Supercrawl, clearly not our first rodeo. So it's people are just there and have the vision, it's amazing what we can accomplish. Jason Farr with us, Councillor, City of Hamilton, talking about King Street and opening up between Gage and the Gore just to get some sort of street festivity happening in the next year. Jason, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
And thank you, Scott.
Seems every time we have this man on, there's like two or three things we have to talk about and very little time to squeeze it all in. So we're going to do our best here. The U.S. drone strike, or a U.S. drone strike, has killed an Al-Qaeda leader considered one of the masterminds behind 9/11 on the balcony of a Kabul safe house this weekend. Many are concerned it has intensified global security scrutiny, rather, around Afghan's Taliban rulers. To talk more, Elliot Tepper, Emeritus Professor of Political Science, Carleton University. He is here now. Elliot, as always, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Well, thank you. Same to you, Scott.
It seemed this came out of nowhere. All of a sudden, a former Al-Qaeda leader, a prominent one, taken out by a drone. The significance of this and why now?
Well, the significance is that Al-Qaeda, for a bunch of things, actually, the key thing is that a top terrorist in the world is now dead. This was taken out by a drone, two Hellfire missiles fired from a drone in the heart of Kabul. So the top leader of Al-Qaeda, having replaced Osama bin Laden, is now dead. And as President Biden said, justice is now done for the 3,000 or so people killed and many, many more wounded after the 9/11 attack. So that's the number one takeaway.
Obviously, we remember when troops packed up and left Afghanistan. What significance does this have in where Afghanistan is now and what is going on there now?
Yes, that's the second major element of all this, is that the Doha Agreement, the agreement by which the U.S. basically turned over Afghanistan, this was under Donald Trump, followed by Joe Biden, so it's bipartisan in that sense. Afghanistan was once again turned back over to the Taliban after all the years of fighting and the progress in democracy and rights of women. All of that is gone now. The Taliban are in charge. They pledged that, as part of the agreement, that Afghanistan would never be a base for terrorism again. And here they are clearly harboring, or at least one faction of the Taliban. And that's a story unto itself. There are factions within the Taliban, but they clearly were harboring the number one terrorist in the world. A $25 million bounty on his head, and he has survived since 9/11 until now.
Hmm. So where does this put relations between the two? Does this intensify that conflict?
Quite clearly, the Taliban, what a big surprise, can't be trusted. The U.S. needed an excuse, it looks like, to get out of Afghanistan, to get out of the never-ending war. The promises made were clearly quite flimsy to begin with, and that's been followed through on by the violation. Meanwhile, the Taliban are in charge of Afghanistan, which is falling apart economically. Half of the population, more or less, is under the poverty line. The possibility of widespread humanitarian disaster is looming. How do you deal with the government of the day when the government of the day is like this? So there's $3.5 billion still frozen of Afghan money. Will the U.S. release that? The possibility of the Taliban regaining any kind or gaining any kind of international legitimacy is clearly affected by the fact they are harboring the number one terrorist in the world in downtown Kabul. But all of this, we have to emphasize, means the bottom line again, as we talk about what all this means, is that the people of Afghanistan are going to continue to pay the cost.
How concerned is the rest of the world in what is happening there and you know, future attacks such?
People have, I think, moved away from that era of the 9/11, post-9/11 era, when the world changed. Or did the U.S. change and not the world? The world seemed to be moving on, and what to do about the Taliban was way down the list. But now it's back, at least toward the center of attention again. There is a regime in power that holds power, that is the government, but not yet the legitimized government of Afghanistan. And it is potentially, once again, harboring terrorists that can affect the rest of the world one way or another. So Afghanistan is back in our news. not in a good way, although the news itself suggests that the U.S., and this is what the U.S. is now claiming, is we don't need to be there anymore. We can still strike down terrorists without having an army in the field. That overlooks the fact that they do obviously have CIA or other informants in the field. They do have human intelligence of one kind or another, but drone technology is changing the nature of war. And the leader of Al-Qaeda has, as Joe Biden said, been brought to justice as a result.
All right. The other story, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi arrives in Taiwan on Tuesday, becoming the highest ranking American official to be there in 25 years. What does this say? Why do this now?
Yes, I think more than one thing, again, once is at play. Everybody in the United States, top leadership, the military and security and defense people all told her don't go because China is very sensitive on the issue of Taiwan, and we don't need another crisis right now. We've got Ukraine, and we have a bombshell report by Thomas Friedman saying that the Chinese possibly will now provide military support for the first time to the Russians, even though they have been supporting the Russians by buying oil from them at a discount, and who knows by other means, but they've not been providing military support. So why upset the apple cart now? I think one thing that's been totally underestimated and not even been highlighted at all is that this was her decision and this is her farewell tour. She's been a lifetime supporter of Taiwan against China and against the depredations of China. And she is likely to be losing power in a few months. So this was her farewell tour. The whole question now is how will China react? And that's what we're waiting for right now. And I've got my own views on that.
What are your views on that? We've only got about 30 seconds left. And how does Biden feel about this?
Well, Biden is, he said, I told her not to go. I can't control her. So the message going out is nothing has changed. The difference between yesterday and today is in terms of policy, in terms of what matters, has not changed whatsoever. But we should keep in mind that China has been behaving in a belligerent fashion. Again, bullying fashion under Xi Jinping in a way that says if this is how a new emerging superpower is going to behave and Taiwan is the test case, then we have to recall that's the nature of China, not the nature of Taiwan.
Emeritus Professor of Political Science with Carleton University, Elliot Tepper. As always, Elliot, thanks for the time. Be well.
Thank you, and same to you.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Shortly after stepping off an Air Force plane in Taipei, Pelosi issued a statement saying her visit honors America's commitment to backing the self-ruled island's vibrant democracy. China claims Taiwan as its territory and sees visits by foreign officials as recognition of the island's sovereignty, warning Pelosi against visiting. Both she and the Biden administration say her arrival does not signal any shift in U.S. policy toward Taiwan, but Beijing's accusing Washington of a betrayal and says it will conduct targeted military operations to safeguard national sovereignty. Sagar Magani, Washington.
And many are asking why now? Why bother? Let's bring in Brian J. Karam, political analyst for CNN, White House reporter, columnist for Salon.com, the Washington diplomat and host of Just Ask the Question podcast, and author of the book Free the Press, The Death of American Journalism and How to Revive It. Brian, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Doing well, Scott. How are you doing? You all right?
Yeah, I can't complain. You know, many are saying that this isn't very good timing. Even Biden suggested that, you know, he can't control her. It's not her. It's not up to him to stop her from going. Why would she want to do this now?
Well, I'm sure that while he says he can't control her, you have to guess that there was no big pushback from the president for her arrival. And I think it's part of the continuing chess game that we play with China in the Far East. I don't think there's any way she would have gone had President Biden said, don't go.
So what's the purpose of this at this time, especially considering where we are with the situation in the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Why now on the world stage?
Well, that's the ultimate question, isn't it? And the bottom line is that when you talk to people in state and those who have who look over these issues, it's something that they believe that the United States has to do in order to stand up to hegemony from China, and that they are concerned about growing Chinese power in the region, and they're anxious to let people know that America is still the kingmaker and still the, you know, the shining light on top of the hill, which, you know, Donald Trump didn't do for about 4 or 5 years.
Has the Russian invasion of Ukraine become a distraction from all of this? Is this to, I guess, everyone to take note? We're still keeping our eye on the rest of the world.
Yeah, I think it to some extent that's correct. And to some extent, the Biden administration is looking to move beyond. I mean, it's had some key victories in legislation in Congress. It's looking to establish its footprint as leaders across the world as we move into the 2022 midterm elections. And so this is another area where strategically Democrats have can say, listen, we're on top of this. We did this and no one else did it. We're the leaders. You need to vote for us. And that's for the disaffected voter in the United States who, you know, for some reason or other still looks at Donald Trump for leadership, which is, to me, you know, like looking to a serial rapist for morality. At least it gives those people another venue to look at, another window to look through for leadership that's not Donald Trump, the Trumplicans, or what's left of the Republican Party.
What's liable to be the fallout from China on all of this? They say they're going to retaliate in some way. What does that mean?
Well, you know, your guess is as good as mine, and I can't, and speaking with my sources here in D.C., they're not real sure what it means. Economic? I mean, they're going to show a flash of, I mean, they're heavily invested in the United States, but they're not going to pull those investments. At the end of the day, I think that what you'll hear from State Department officials and from this administration is that they're less worried about any real reaction to this because we are too intermeshed economically with China at this point. They make money off of us. So they are content to listen to whatever yelling will go on from Beijing, but at the same time aren't too worried about what it is that Beijing will do.
Do you think are American officials concerned that this will change the situation with China's involvement with Russia and the invasion of Ukraine? Are they concerned that China will retaliate and give Russia more support?
Well, I don't think you're going to see it. You know, honestly, sure, there would be some concern there. But at the end of the day, Russia doesn't have the economy that United States does. And if it's a choice of you know, going to the American table to eat or to the Russian table to eat, there really is no choice in that matter. Russia knows it, China knows it, and America knows it. So at the end of the day, whatever it is that they claim that they're going to do, I think will pale in comparison to what they'll really do. And what they'll really do is invest money. It's all about the money.
We certainly saw what happened to Hong Kong and obviously Taiwan in a precarious situation as well. Is it just a matter of time before Taiwan ends up like Hong Kong?
No, I don't think there's ever a chance that there is some legitimate concern that for Chinese invasion of Taiwan. That's a legitimate concern. However, immediate or not, this move had to be made, this administration felt, to show that we still support, our motives haven't changed, our support hasn't changed, it hasn't weakened. So if you, in fact, what they're saying to China is, if, in fact, you believe that you're going to invade Taiwan, not on my watch. If you want to adopt the hardline strategy, that's the hardline strategy that may be being transmitted by Nancy Pelosi landing there and saying, you know, and visiting, is that now, look, if you think you're really going to take over Taiwan, we were just here. I don't think you really want to do that.
All right. But, the other big story. Sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Go ahead. The only thing I was going to say is, but at the same time, we all have to realize that this is a dangerous game of brinkmanship either way it goes. And you can't get away from that.
All right, the other big story, Al-Qaeda leader taken out in a drone strike, obviously instrumental in 9/11. This seemed to come out of nowhere. Surprised by this? What's the word down there?
No, I don't think there's... I mean, there is surprise that it happened when it happened, but the United States has a long memory for 9/11. Watching the World Trade Center's collapse is emblazoned on the minds, in the minds and hearts and souls of everybody in the U.S. And the one thing that has been consistent across every administration since 2001 is that if the United States can find those responsible, it will make those who are responsible for 9/11 pay. Unless, of course, it's the Saudi Arabian family and we want their oil money. Other than that...
All right, Brian J. Cram with us, political analyst for CNN, White House reporter, columnist for Salon.com and The Washington Diplomat. Just Ask the Question podcast and the book, Free the Press, The Death of American Journalism and How to Revive It. Brian, as always, thank you for the time. Be well.
You too, my friend. Have fun.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
You know, it's been fascinating going through this global pandemic and wherever we are now, living with it, what have you. I think many thought that things would be more close to what the old normal was. But that being said, when you go through something for 2.5 years, how can anything ever be the same? What does this mean for commuting? What does this mean from working from home? What does this mean to the footprints of downtowns who traditionally would have had office towers and such, specifically the major cities like Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver? A new study suggests that Toronto's economic recovery is lagging behind other urban centers. One of its authors says that has become clear, and we may not be going back to whatever the old normal was. This based on cell phone towers tracking various urban centers. It found that the level of cell activity measured in downtown Toronto between March and May this year, only about 46% of what it was pre-pandemic. What does this mean for the city and the headquarters now that we're where we are with this pandemic? Let's bring in Dr. Karen Chappell, who is director of the School of Cities, the University of Toronto, and one of the co-authors of this study, and with us now. Karen, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me.
I think this is a fascinating issue. You can't go through something for 2.5 years and come out the other end the same, whatever going back to normal is. Do we know even at this point what it's going to look like in the future? Or are we still figuring it out?
Well, it is a work in progress, but I think we know enough. Just, you know, based on the stage that we're at, we call this late pandemic phase. And so things are kind of shaking out as they will look for at least the next year or so. Like, we won't expect, a huge movement back downtown by the end of the year, right? We've basically settled into the kind of equilibrium that we'll see in the future.
So what does this mean for the footprints of companies or headquarters or what have you that have normally been, you know, in some cases, monuments in downtowns? What happens to them? Do they still need the space? Do they have to look at, other options? How big an issue is this?
Well, I think it's a different story for different downtowns or different types of businesses. So many employers have settled on a new routine with their workers where they'll come in 2 or 3 days a week. Some have tried to crack down and said you have to come in 5 days a week. But others are cautious about it because they could lose their workers. There's a skilled labor shortage in the country, and you don't want to piss off your employees more.
Mm-hmm.
So companies have to be super careful. And then there's certain companies where you can actually do remote work, and it's going to be fine for your productivity. Other types of businesses have to come back in person, So those will continue, but all in all, we're not going to see downtowns in Canada come back to 100% of what they were 3 years ago. If they remain the same, if they have the same economic composition of 3 years ago, in order to come back, they're going to have to change a bit.
So will cities change as we know them? Will they have a different look to them, especially when you think about a residential aspect? Are cities changing as a result of this? Will they look different?
I think what we've seen a number of cities in great position to take advantage of returning to normal. And, you know, we were shocked when we did the study that number one city in North America is Salt Lake City. Who would have dreamt? And that's because what Salt Lake did a couple things right. It built a lot of new residential downtown and developments that opened up just in the last couple of years. And people flocked there because it was quiet and they could live near work and so forth. There's the cities that have very diverse economies they're not overly specialized in professional work. They're doing super well, and there's a lesson there for Canadian cities that we got to diversify. We got to make sure we welcome arts and entertainment and tourism and food and accommodation and manufacturing or, you know, different types of craft shops or, you know, different types of uses downtown, not just professional services.
Are new templates being created for cities? It sounds like it's a pretty exciting time, although it's change and some don't like that. But is there a new template being created here?
Well, I think we do see in Toronto, too, and all throughout Canada, we see the emergence of parkettes and different uses of the street space, more amenities, more walkable streets. And a lot of that is since the pandemic, and a lot of that is becoming permanent. And I think that that's going to be a good thing for us to think about our cities, our downtowns, as 24-hour places, not 9-to-5.
We hear a lot, especially in the city of Hamilton, about infill development within the city boundaries, repurposing, whether it's an old parking lot, an old vacant lot, an old this, an old that, or what have you. Should we be using those spaces for residents and high density, stacking people up like cordwood, or should we be using those places to make things like parkettes, things that are alternatives for people who live in high rises?
Well, I don't think it's an either or thing, because the parkettes are actually going to only be nice if you actually have people downtown. You don't want to have parkettes in abandoned areas, right? So you need the people. You don't have to stack them up like cordwood. You could sort of go in between. I think you could actually, have a nice mid-size 8-to-12 story development, which are human scale, still bring a lot of people downtown, but perhaps it can be even more affordable. Maybe they're timber built and not steel frame. So there's ways of doing this where we can have it all.
Will we see more residential moving into business areas?
We should. I think though the challenge for some of our older downtowns and the ones that have a lot of Class B and C commercial space, older office buildings, those buildings are really hard to convert to residential. They're not laid out right. The ceilings are low. The plumbing is in the wrong place. The HVAC is not appropriate for 24-hour living. These are real physical challenges. So you might, in the end, have to see some of those older towers come down and then replaced with more flexible structures.
Dr. Karen Chappell with us, director of the School of Cities, University of Toronto, one of the co-authors of this study. Going to be fascinating to see what our cities look like as we move forward. Doctor, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Yeah, sure. Take care.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
I'm speaking with the Ontario Nurses College. I'm speaking with the CPSO to see how we as a province can ensure that those internationally trained individuals can be not fast-tracked but processed as quickly as possible. So I think there will be ebbs and flows as we go through a higher vacation period or breaks in the summer vacations.
All right, that is Health Minister Sylvia Jones, opposition screaming and yelling because I guess she's been on a holiday and she hasn't been around to address all their concerns in regard to the Canadian healthcare system. And, you know, I knew this would happen. We talked about this during the global pandemic, and there were cries from provinces right the way across the country underneath the guide of Premier Horgan in British Columbia, saying that, you know, the provincial healthcare systems, and we know it is a provincial responsibility, are doing a great job. What the issue is the funding formula. And if the feds can't pay for it, how are the provinces supposed to pay for it? So once again, the pandemic is over. You know, politicians need some hay, or need to make some hay. So here we are again, directing a provincial band-aid to something which is a federal funding problem. Are we going to actually fix the failing Canadian healthcare system, the one that we brag about so much, or are we just going to push this off into each individual provinces to apply the band-aids as needed, as we've seen in the past? Again, the health minister talking today about issues of staffing shortages and such as of the last holiday weekend. Let's bring in David Tarrant, Vice President, National Strategic Communications, Enterprise Canada, former communications strategist in the office of the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, and with us now. David, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me on the program.
You know, I've been concerned about this since the pandemic began because, again, we certainly know that healthcare is a provincial jurisdiction. That being said, at one time, our illustrious Canadian healthcare system was funded 50-50 by the provinces and the feds. Now, the provinces are getting maybe just over 20% from the feds, and are basically stuck to try to fix an ailing system with smaller coffers than what the feds have. Are we going to continue to put provincial band-aids on this problem, or are we actually going to have the big boy or the big girl discussion about we need a change here in the Canadian healthcare system? It's broken.
It's a great question, Scott. And listen, at the fundamental when it comes to the federal government and the provincial government healthcare, it's about money versus control. Right, and the federal government, you know, from the early days of Canada Health Act, they wanted to put in place national standards on the provinces in return for a big check to pay for it. And because they, as you pointed out so well at the beginning, constitutionally it's clear the provinces have responsibility for health care. Like that, there's no question about that. So the only way the federal government could shape policy or dictate terms was to make a contingent on funding. And that's what they did. But with each passing year, as healthcare needs rise, as the population gets older and healthcare needs get more complex, it gets more and more expensive. And what you have right now is a federal government that still wants to have the same amount of control that it had when it was paying 50% of the, 50 cents of the dollar, when proportionally that contribution is cut by more than half. And yeah, there's other problems have a point here. If you're going to insist on calling the tune out and choosing the song, you got to be ready to dance. And certainly, what we see right now is the federal government has not been willing to actually put the dollars into the system that are commensurate with what the demands are making of the provinces.
Haven't Canadians learned enough through the global pandemic to see where the faults and you know the dents are in this armor? I mean, because here we are today, in the middle of the summer, you know, the opposition is screaming because they haven't heard from the health minister on this issue. Again, it's about politics. Look over here when we're not addressing the real problem, which is the Canadian healthcare system.
Yeah, and the need of politicians, I look at the Prime Minister and the federal cabinet on this. They want stuff that they can announce that has the pretty picture at the photo op. Listen, Scott, I've worked in government. Like, that's what you want to do when you're in government. And that's so why do you see the Prime Minister spend all this time over the last couple of years, campaigning for a national child care program? Yes, child care is an important issue, but why? Because it gave him something to announce. It gave him an excuse to travel around from city to city across the country and pose for people and saying he was creating something new and shiny. There's no sexy announcement in actually, paying your bills on time, right? There's no big photo op. There's no big commercial you can make about that, about actually paying your way the way you promised you would. And so actually giving more money to the provinces, paying your share to the provinces, that's not an announceable. Traveling on the press, however, finding the money to announce new programs, well, the federal government loves doing that. This federal government loves doing that. And, you know, and that's politics. They want announceables. It is not, however, the best way to build a healthcare system that actually respects patients and families.
Why, as Canadians, are we to assume that pharmacare, dental care, child care, these are all great ideas, but why would it be any different than health care? And that after a few years, the provinces are paying for all this too. I mean, you're setting up all of these systems on an already broken, flawed template.
Yeah, if your basement's flooding, you probably shouldn't be investing your money into for a new in-ground pool. Right. Instead, what the government, because they want the Trudeau government wants to announce new shiny objects, like you said, dental care, pharmacare. Look at all the new things we're creating, but they can't even execute the things we're supposed to be doing today. And for me, the concern is not just as someone who uses the healthcare system as you do or as your listeners do. What makes us think that 20 years from now, 10 years ago, a national child care system will be falling apart?
Exactly.
Or a national dental care system will be falling apart? Because once there's nothing left to announce, they'll get distracted, the share of funding will decrease again, and the province will be left holding the bag for a federal promise that they no longer are interested in paying for. And that's the real challenge here. And if you don't think that will happen with the child care, well, it's exactly what happened in healthcare, Scott. And so people, I think, should the first order of business, I don't care if it's in your family, if it's in business, if it's in life, you have to take care of the fundamentals, take care of your obligations, before you start shopping around for something new, right? If you can't pay the power bill, don't buy a new TV, right? The federal government is not paying its power bill. They're not paying their fair share of healthcare expenses. So why are they going down to Best Buy and trying to pick up a new piece of electronics? It's just not the right way to run a government, a family, household, or a business.
And, of course, another Band-Aid solution for our healthcare system as opposed to getting to the root of the problem. David Tarrant with us, Vice President, National Strategic Communications, Enterprise Canada. David, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thanks, Scott. Take care.
All right. We've certainly been aware of what has been happening with Hockey Canada of late and a case that came out, I believe it was in May, and then... more and more information coming out about allegations and slush funds used to pay off some of these allegations and such, and many questioning the culture of Hockey Canada, its direction, and certainly looking for, I guess, those in the upper echelon of this organization to step aside. Let's bring in Stephen Ellis, web editor for the Hockey News. He is with us now. Stephen, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
So we've certainly heard lots about this in various industries and such. Now, obviously, it's Hockey Canada. Certainly not the first rodeo here. Do you think we're going to see change, or is this just a PR strategy to make it look like there's change and just kind of put this behind them? What are we going to see out of Hockey Canada as a result of this?
It's kind of tough to say right now. On one hand, they've been public and, it took a while to get some statements out of them to kind of acknowledge everything going on and kind of the nature of everything. It's tough, but it does seem like something, at least behind the scenes, we should expect a lot coming up. Of course, it's kind of like weird timing when you look at the fact that they're hosting the Holinka Gretzky right now and about to host the World Juniors in Edmonton next week. So a bunch of major events kind of right after everything's kind of coming out, but obviously a lot of change has to happen. There's been talks about do we need to have a new CEO, do we need a new president, everything like that, and I do expect changes, but at this point it's kind of just in limbo as we kind of wait to all everything going on.
Is there any way that the upper echelons of this can stay intact? I mean, whether you've designed the culture or not, you're certainly enabling it. Can they make the change, or does there need to be changes in the upper echelons of Hockey Canada?
I think at the very least, the kind of the public trust, the public approval has been gone completely. And that alone would be an issue. When you look at the fact that funds by players kind of at different levels of hockey being used to pay off victims like this, you can't have that. And obviously a lot of families are probably going to react in a way of, okay, well, we can't support this and we don't want to be a part of this next year. And so there will have to be a trickle-down effect. But there were some key members of Hockey Canada that weren't involved in either of these situations, either 2018 or 2003. But I think you just kind of have to start fresh if you look at it and say, okay, well, this was allowed to happen. This was known, things like that. Nothing really changed. Obviously, I think something has to happen.
Obviously, when we think of Hockey Canada, we think of the World Juniors and the great tournament every year and such and what happens there. But obviously, we're hearing a lot from minor hockey associations, especially when you're hearing that their fees are being, sent to slush funds and such. What about the minor hockey fallout and just the declining attendance in hockey?
Yeah, for sure. And we've heard there's been stories about different hockey organizations and minor hockey groups like not paying their dues, not wanting to be a part of this right now. And I wouldn't be shocked if we see some junior leagues, maybe in the CJHL or other levels, kind of back out and say we want to do our own thing because, hockey in Canada, at a certain point, there was going to be kind of a decline in growth because there were going to be just so many people playing hockey that eventually you couldn't just keep growing in a major way, but there were numbers down, and then now you're looking at this now, and if there's ever been a time for a new family trying to get into the sport, trying to see if it's worth putting your kid in it, you look at it and say, well, look at all that's going on. Look at everything that's come out about this, and it's hard to support that. So I do expect there to be kind of fallout from young hockey families, whether new or existing, and then hockey organizations kind of feeling the fallout because of it.
Do you think this is just going to affect views in and around assault allegations or the culture of such? Or do you think it's actually going to filter down to the lowest levels of hockey? I've had two kids in hockey for years, both a boy and a girl, and had great experiences through just playing house league and such. But I often ask, well, why are we spending so much time skating around pylons and not more time actually playing the game? And I remember hearing from coaches, they don't want us teaching game time scenarios. They want us teaching skills. Is it time to readjust that? And, you're sitting watching kids leaning up against a board waiting in turn for, their chance to skate around the pylon. They'd much rather be playing, 3-on-3, 4-on-4, whatever. Do you think this is going to change culture beyond the sexual assault allegations and such?
I think first and foremost, hockey needs to be fun. Like the majority of kids playing hockey are not going to go to the NHL. I know I definitely did not. And it's got to be fun. And obviously having situations like this, the higher levels, you got to question, is this something that happens more elsewhere? There's a lot of people came out either privately or publicly and said, there's been situations here and here and here. And it's things that you just can't ignore. And these are definitely not isolated incidents, the ones in 2018 and 2003. But then again, just that's kind of the lower levels of hockey, just looking outside of all the scandals going on right now. It's got to be fun for the kids. So maybe we just have to overall, whether it's being the culture, whether it's just being kind of just how hockey is just treated in this country, which obviously is a big deal, it maybe needs a full refresh here. And that's when you look at people saying like, okay, maybe Hockey Canada has to dissolve. Well, if you do that, then you have to have a new group come in and take over and do a good job, but have to be a fresh group. This can't be kind of just a restructuring of what we have. So there's a lot of ways that Hockey Canada or just the sport in general here can go. And it's so complicated. It's not as easy as just saying Hockey Canada shut down right now. It would be an issue, but it's something where I think we're going to see a lot of changes at some point. And I hope it's sooner rather than later.
How do you think this is going to affect sponsorship when it comes to hockey, whether it's the minor, the little kid going in on the weekend or those that are sponsoring, world juniors or whatever? Do you think this is going to affect sponsorship of these events?
Well, I really hope that it doesn't hurt the lower levels of hockey, the house league, the kids that are just trying to do this for fun. I hope it doesn't impact them because to me that wouldn't be fair. But you look at these major events, and you look at the World Juniors about to happen. It was already a tough time to sell that tournament. And then you throw in all the scandals going on with the team, the Hockey Canada. And then you look at the fact that Russia was kicked out of the tournament too. So there's that. There's a lot of things kind of surrounding these tournaments. And I think if you're going to attack anything, attack those big tournaments and these big events that can survive. If you're a sponsor and you're involved in this, that's something you back out. I would hate to see younger kids and then people not affected by this, unfortunately, get hit by this. But sponsorship will always happen in hockey in Canada. It's obviously one of the biggest things we got, and it's so important to so many people. But at a certain point, you gotta you gotta speak with your money, and that's why you see these major sponsors that have said, you know what, we're gonna stop supporting, we're gonna stop funding these big events. That to me is a good step, but I just would hate to see younger kids kind of get hurt from this too.
Stephen Ellis with us, web editor for the Hockey News, talking about Hockey Canada and revelations we're discovering about them and what they need to do moving forward and saving minor hockey in all of this. Steve, thanks for the time. Much appreciated. Be well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
All right, let's bring in Scott Radley, host of the Scott Radley Show. You can read him in your Hamilton Spectator, and it's coming up right after the 6 o'clock news. Scott, I hope you're doing well.
Hey, just back from vacation. Could not, well, I could be better. I could still be on vacation, but otherwise could not be better.
There you go. I was off the week before you. It's always fun to get away. Do you, in a post-pandemic world, do you have a different set of priorities now that you are back? Has it changed your thought? Has it changed your way of life?
Since I'm back now?
Yeah.
No, my priority is as soon as I go off on vacation. Yeah, I have rules on vacation, Scott. They're not like, you know, There are rules to live by, but they're not that big a deal. But one of them, so we go up to a cottage and I fish a lot, and I'm terrible at fishing. I'm enthusiastic, but I haven't a clue what I'm doing. So there's that. I like to, like, I clean out all the seaweed in the lake for all the other fishermen. I'm doing a community service, really. But when we're not there, the other rule I have is I'm a fast reader, and I read a lot of books when I'm on vacation, but the rule is, I cannot read any books that will in any way enhance my intelligence or better my life. They have to be brain deadening books, just stupidity.
Right.
Right? And so and I mean, I can't, like, thrillers, you know, like John Grisham or whatever, they count. But, you know, a few years ago, I read The History of Kiss on vacation, which is hilarious and it's fascinating, but it's not in any way going to inform my life to do anything different. I'm not following in the footsteps of Gene Simmons or Paul Stanley, but it's that kind of stuff. You just have to, your brain has to escape.
Is that what it's about for you? Because to me, it's like, if I'm reading The History of Kiss, I'm feeling that I'm not taking good advantage of the time that's been afforded to me.
That's exactly.
I should be doing something more productive or even more restful than reading The Story of Kiss.
Oh, no, see, because that's, to me, again, if you follow the rule, that is, you can't read anything that is, you know, you're supposed to finish it and go, I have to remember some of the lessons from that book. That was a really impactful book on my life.
Right.
I've done it wrong. This has to be stuff where you can read 15 pages, and if you drift off and fall asleep, you can pick it up and open wherever that book was, and you go, I don't remember exactly where I was, but here, I'll start here, and it's fine. You can just pick up and go.
So is this
you and I, Scott, our jobs are not physically demanding.
No, but you do a lot of reading. It's a lot of consuming of information. We consume a lot of information.
Right. And people have different things. If you're a nurse or someone, let's say, or you're in construction where you're on your feet and you're working all day, it's different. You want to have a physical break. I just want to have a not thinking about anything break. So that's probably not a great setup for what's coming up on the show tonight. two weeks of the brain being completely turned off. But you know what? You need it. And especially, Scott, you know what? You mentioned you started this with COVID. It's not entirely all to do with COVID, but like everybody for the last 2 years, it's just a surge of information and this and that and everything all the time. You have to sometimes turn your brain off or you go crazy.
I'm successful at that for a couple of days, but then, you know, because you get burnt out. Again, there's the saying, the porch light's always on in our business. And then you sort of start to go through withdrawal. So, like, towards the end of the week, I'm just going to start, you know, I'm going to look at something and read something on this. And it's, you know, it's work. It's current events. It's what I would normally be consuming anyway. And then all of a sudden, I'm, like, screaming at the top of my lungs about the politics of the day, and everybody's looking at me like, why don't you just shut it off? So how do you avoid not looking like, you know, whether it's a big sports story?
There's times when you want to, but to me, it's like, you know what? I'll have lots of time to do that. Force yourself. Like, I force myself when I'm out fishing. I have my phone with me because of the camera that's on it, in case I ever catch the giant fish that I never catch.
Yes.
But you know, you got to have proof. A few of the ones I caught this year, you could have mistaken them for dental floss, honestly. I mean, I caught some of the smallest fish you've ever seen in your life, but it's not on. Like, I don't have my phone on. I don't have the ringer on. If someone does call me, I don't answer it. And again, I think there was a time when I would have, and I think that's like an awful lot of people. I think the last few years have just really made people say, I just need to step away and not be engaged for a period of time. And, you know, I'm not saying all the time. We don't want to be, you know, apathetic, and we don't want to be ignorant. But for a week or two, man, is it ever helpful.
Now, do you ever read the Kiss book while you're fishing, or is that just...
That would be difficult. Although, considering how many fish I'm reeling in, I have the time. Funny story, there's this old guy who was at the cottage by ours, and he goes out with one rod and one lure, and that's it. And I've got all the stuff, because, you know, if you don't know what you're doing, you got to have more stuff, because that'll solve your problem, which it never does. He goes out with one rod and one lure, and his boat is feet from me, and I see him reeling in this enormous muskie, and it's like, are you kidding? Like, I've tried everything, and all I'm catching is weeds. And this guy caught one thing after another, and I caught a break.
All right, and you can catch a break coming up after the 6 o'clock news. It'll be interesting to see, hear more fishing stories, and exactly what the Brain Dead show is going to sound like.
Yeah,
Scott Radley, there you go. Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. You can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. Have a great show, and thanks always to Scott. Much appreciated.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, greatly appreciated. Thanks to the two Wills for producing, and Diane and Dave in the newsroom. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word.
Hey, it's Tom. That open street thing about the street festival, that could work around Tim Hortons Field every game day. Why don't we get our old lemonade stands going? Off you, wee-wee!
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.